Recently, we featured T.J. McConnell here on Fresh 24. Now, we feature Nick Stauskas, T.J.'s good friend. How good?
The most underrated Sixers player ever.
T.J. McConnell?
Favorite Sixers teammate ever.
T.J. McConnell.
Funniest Sixers teammate you ever had.
T.J. McConnell.
There's a theme here.
We'll hit on a number of themes, including the process, with former Sixer Nick Stauskas. Next on Fresh 24.
Now Covington for three. Oh, and there's Stauskas to throw it down. Hold me back, fam. Sixers lock all windows and doors.
Nicholas Tomas Stauskas, Canadian, Lithuanian heritage, 8 years in the NBA, two with the Sixers, honing in on 30. Sauce Castillo, brother, what's going on?
Not much, just living the dream. Excited to be chopping it up with you. It's been a minute, Mark. I'm excited to be here today.
It's been a minute, and you did live the dream. You played basketball and got paid to play, but you're not anymore. People would naturally expect at 30 that you would still be playing. Why aren't you?
That's a very interesting question. I would say a number of things played into that decision, but basically in the 2021-22 season, I was playing in the G League, got called up by the Celtics. We went to the finals and lost to that Warriors team. And I was on a two-year deal with the Celtics, the second year being a team option. So, my goal was just, do everything I could, everything in my power to have them bring me back for a second year. And that summer, they ended up trading me to Indiana for Malcolm Brogdon. And so while the trade happened, in order for the trade to go through and like the salaries to match up, the Pacers had to pick up my team option, which was great. But, Boston sent like five players to Indiana. Indiana sent one player to Boston. So Indiana just didn't have the roster space to keep all of us. And so they ended up waiving me. And while, the salary was guaranteed, I was now a free agent again. And so I had just kind of like done the EuroLeague thing, G League, and I had really put myself through a lot to get back to the NBA. And just the timing of it all, my daughter was born in September 12th of 2022. And as you know, that's typically when teams are starting to, gear up for training camp and preseason and whatnot. And I was ready to go. But I told my agent, I said, look, if I'm going to leave my wife and my newborn baby, it's got to be for something that's real, something that I'm going to be actually, a team that believes in me and wants to give me a chance. Because, I had been on this roller coaster where, team after team, year after year, move in different places. And, once you have a wife and kid, it's not as easy as just like picking up your bags and then going to the next spot. And so I just told him, I said, look, I'm ready to keep going. I'm ready to head out anywhere, but you have to tell me that it's a legit chance. Like they're not going to just send me back down to the G League or whatever. And when it came down to it, I didn't have a clear path to making a roster in training camp. And for me, I just wasn't willing to go back down to that G League route. Like I had done it the previous year in my final two games in the G League. Like I had 57 and 43 in a 24-hour span, and just felt like I had shown that I belong in the NBA level. And so approaching 29 years old, like I was just realistic with myself and I said, man, like, I am what I am at this point, you know, like what they saw for me last year in that throughout the G League and throughout the NBA season, like that's who I am. And there's no switch that I'm going to flip. That's all of a sudden going to turn me into this like reinvented new player. And so I kind of just came to grips with the fact that like, look, if I want to continue playing basketball, it's going to be a lot more of, you know, this team to team, city to city, country to country, maybe. And after doing it for 8 years, 9 years, it just wasn't something that interested me anymore. Like I always told my wife that once we had kids, I wanted to be there and not always be on the go. And I didn't want to start my daughter's life in a way where it was just constant chaos and stress. So, you know, I made that decision to peacefully walk away from the game. But it's a little bit maddening only because, you know, again, my last year playing professional basketball in the G League and with the Celtics, in some ways I felt like I was the best I've ever been. You know, shooting the ball, you know, well over 40% that year. My body was holding up pretty well. It was really that thing, you know, a lot of people say 28 to 32, you kind of hit that prime where it's the mind and body kind of, they hit that peak where the two are very connected. And that's how I felt in that last season. So it was hard for me to walk away knowing that I could still very much play at that level. But I also knew that it wasn't something that was going to bring me and my family the most happiness. So, you know, made the decision to step away.
By the way, we're going to talk plenty of hoops. We're going to talk about your time with the Sixers. I just wanted to add that you dropped, 57 in a G League game. You had 11 threes. The next night you had 43, a total of 100. And that came on the anniversary of Wilt scoring 100 in a game. But to me, that's crazy. We recently had your boy TJ McConnell on. And he said at the time that you and your wife were going to visit, did you eventually do that?
No. So he actually came to visit us.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, TJ is a big soccer guy. And so he came to Philly, he drove from Pittsburgh to Philly, and then, him and I, and then one of our friends, we took like a sprinter van down to New York, and we went to go see the Manchester United versus Arsenal game at MetLife Stadium, which was, I'm not a soccer guy, it was an awesome atmosphere. Yeah. And I couldn't believe that was just like an exhibition match, you know, like wasn't even anything, you know, that they're really playing for, because the energy and just the whole atmosphere of the building was, you know, it was phenomenal. So TJ's been trying to convert me to be a soccer fan.
It's a great sport, by the way. And he's got an interest in Leeds United, right?
Yes, he does. He's now, you know, part owner of the team. And it's crazy. Like when I was playing with TJ, I never heard him talk about soccer. And now it's all he talks about. He's so passionate about it. He loves watching. He loves following it. So, you know, I can see why, though. The games are definitely a lot of fun to go to.
So growing up in Canada, you didn't play soccer. And to a lot of people's surprise, I guess, you really didn't play hockey that much. Why basketball?
I was playing soccer when I was, 5 or 6 years old. And, I thought that was going to be my thing. I liked it a lot. And then I was playing in a game one day and bam, someone tripped me. I fell and I broke my arm when I fell. And, you know, being a 5, 6-year-old kid, I got it in my head that, soccer was bad luck and that I was going to get hurt if I played again. So I, you know, had to switch it up. And at the time, I was pretty tall for my age, and my uncle was the coach of a Lithuanian church league team for you know, this basketball league. And he's like, "Oh, why don't you come join our team? You're going to be one of like the taller guys." And I had never played before, never touched basketball, but I showed up to like the first practice, and I was just kind of like naturally had a feel for it, and it was just a vicious cycle where the more I played, the better I got. And the better I got, the more I wanted to play. And it kind of spiraled from there.
And you got so good, you eventually went to prep school in the U.S. and you became a high school star and heavily recruited. Is it true that Jay Wright and Villanova recruited you, and were the Wildcats even a possibility at that point?
So the interesting thing about Villanova, which, by the way, I'm like a 8 minute drive. I live like maybe 8 minutes away from Villanova. Mm. The crazy thing is that Villanova is the only other school that I visited other than Michigan. Mm. I didn't visit anywhere else, but at the same time, they never really like heavily recruited me. You know, I remember maybe when I was like 15 years old, we had a tournament here in the Philly area, my Canadian AAU team. And after one of our games, our coach took our whole team, you know, to meet Jay Wright and to kind of take a tour of their facilities. And so, I mean, there was a little bit of interest, but I wouldn't say they were ever like, you know, seriously recruiting me. For me, my main two schools I was really deciding between were Michigan and Iowa State. Fred Hoiberg at Iowa State was one of the guys that I had a really good relationship with. So those were like the main two for me.
So you go to Michigan, you play under a great coach in John Beilein, you lose to Louisville in the NCAA title game. I'm talking about 2013. You were there for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Trey Burke, Tim Hardaway Jr., Glenn Robinson III, Mitch McGarry, Caris LeVert, and you, all NBA players. What a squad. Why isn't it that you – and listen, that Louisville team's great. What kept you from winning at all?
The last 2 minutes of the first half was the absolute – you know, it was the difference in the game. So most people, if you remember that game, Trey Burke picked up two fouls in the first 3 minutes of the game. And Coach Beilein has a rule. If you pick up two fouls in the first half, you don't play again until the second half.
You don't play for the rest of the half? Yeah, a lot of coaches will do that.
And so it's national championship game, and he picks up his second foul. We're all looking like, there's no way he's taking Trey out.
Right.
Like, you know,
he's like, wasn't he national player of the year?
He was national player of the year.
Yeah.
And you can go back and watch the film. In the first 3 minutes of the game, Trey had our first 7 points, came out firing. And I was like, oh, he's leading us to the national. It's a done deal. He picked up the second foul. Coach Beilein sits him down and puts in, at the time, my roommate and, you know, goes on to be the groomsman of my wedding, Spike Albrecht. And Spike ended up becoming a little bit of an overnight celebrity because he comes in the game and goes for 17 in the first half and just torturing Peyton Siva, Russ Smith, and all the Louisville guards, just kind of getting to wherever he wants. And we had a comfortable, you know, 9, 10, 11 point lead with like 2 minutes left. And then Luke Hancock from Louisville, he closed out the half. The last four Louisville possessions, he hit four consecutive threes. And we went into halftime maybe up one or two. And the momentum had just completely shifted. And when we came out in that second half, it was, you know, battle back and forth, but we ended up losing by like 4 or 5 points or whatever it was. So that was a tough one though, because it definitely felt like for the majority of that first half that we had complete control, but basketball is a game of runs for sure.
How'd you make it work with a team like that? Everybody was a bona fide scorer. How were you able to work it out that you had really good chemistry?
Well, I think Coach Beilein, he did a phenomenal job with our offense. We were an okay defensive team. We were nothing special, but my God, we could score the ball with the best of them. And with Trey kind of leading the way, he was an Allen Iverson type of point guard where, you know, he's going to go and get buckets, but you know, he also did a good job of like, you know, coming off a pick and roll and like hitting the guy shaking up on the wing for three, or, you know, in the pick and roll, you know, throwing a lob to one of the bigs. And so there was a good amount of ball movement. And it was one of those things too, where we had so many, you know, guard wing type players where it's like, if you go get a rebound, if I get a rebound or Tim gets a rebound, you know, Karis, we're out and we're running, and then everyone's running their lanes and, you know, just playing basketball together, making the right reads. And Coach Beilein was big on watching film every single day. So, you know, making the right read was something that, you know, we took a lot of pride in, and playing the right way. And it was fun, you know, sharing the ball and seeing everyone succeed and winning. you know, that's ultimately the goal, and it's fun when that's all clicking. So with that team, definitely it felt effortless for us to kind of go through those things where, you know, you kind of contrast that with, you know, some other teams that I've played for throughout my professional career. And once you start comparing those, you're like, damn, that, I don't know if I've ever had as much fun playing basketball as I did with that Michigan team.
Coach Beilein had a brief stint with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and as great as he was in the college level, just couldn't make it work in the NBA. I imagine it's a very difficult transition. Do you ever have a conversation with him about that transition?
For sure. I actually went back to Ann Arbor after.
What did he tell you?
Well, what did he say about the experience, or what did he say?
Yeah.
You know,
about the transition to the NBA from the college ranks.
I warned him ahead of time because, believe it or not, I was on the Cleveland Cavaliers right before he got hired. And so during 2018-2019 season, during our exit interviews, Larry Drew was the coach at that time. He resigned. They're looking for a new coach. And they asked me in my exit interview, what do you think about Coach Beilein? Would he be able to coach this team? And I was like, obviously, love the guy, great coach, phenomenal with the X's and O's. But having seen what I, you know, a number of things in the NBA, whether it be my time with the Sixers or with that Cleveland team, which was very, very bad, by the way. That Cleveland team was post-LeBron horrendous. I just knew it was going to be difficult for him to implement the same things that he was implementing at Michigan because it required people to fully buy into like his way. And as you know, in the NBA, it's not always, the coach doesn't have that much control over who he's getting on the roster and what type of character they have and like what kind of family are they from and, you know, do they play the right way? Coach Beilein was great at Michigan because he was handpicking his players that he knew would fit into his system. And when he came into Cleveland, while they had some very talented players, they weren't necessarily players that were going to fit into what he was looking to do. And so I warned him ahead of time because after my rookie year with the Kings, I went back to Ann Arbor that summer and we sat down, we had lunch together. And I remember then he told me, I want to make the jump to the NBA. Like, I want to find a coaching job in the NBA. And I had just finished playing for the Kings my rookie year, where we had three coaches in 1 year and it was chaos at all times, like behind the scenes in the locker room, chaos. And so I was like, Coach, it's different. Like, it's very, very different than what you have going on here at Michigan. So if you're going to do it, you have to be willing to make some adjustments. And, you know, ultimately I think, first of all, I don't think he was really given a fair shot in Cleveland. Like, they signed him to a 5-year deal and they gave him like 4 months. And granted, that team, like, no matter who you put in as their coach, they weren't going to win that year. So I just feel like they took the easy way out. And, you know, there was a lot of like reports about things that were said in film rooms and rumors and this and that. And, you know, guys talking to the media behind his back. And it was messy. And I feel for him because in some ways it was like it kind of is like tainted his like image as a head coach, because everywhere else he's been super, super successful. And then he has this one stint, which is his last stint. And it was kind of ugly. So I feel for him, but I feel like it shouldn't be, you know, reflected as to like the kind of coach he is, because he's phenomenal. Especially with the X's and O's, one of the best in the business. And I just wish he got a more of a fair shot with that team.
All right, Nick. So we're going to talk about your NBA career and your time with the Sixers and the origin of Sauce Castillo. But first, it is time for our halftime segment. We call it This or That. It's a 6-pack. You have to choose between two things. Are you ready? Don't think about it. Just do it, brother. Here you go. NBA fans, the wait is over. Basketball is back, and DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA, is celebrating with an unbeatable offer. New customers can score $200 instantly in bonus bets for throwing down $5 on the NBA. Win or lose, it doesn't matter. You'll start the season with an instant dub.
And with DraftKings parlays, everyone's got a shot at even bigger basketball wins. String together multiple bets from the same game or build your parlay across multiple games for a shot at making your payday even sweeter. Basketball's more fun when you're in on the action. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code ZOOMOFF. New customers can get $200 in bonus bets instantly for betting just $5. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with code ZOOMOFF. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, licensee partner Golden Nugget Lake Charles, 21 plus age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/basketball. Terms for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms and responsible gaming resources. Check out our friends over at Philadelphia Sports Nation, a local Philadelphia sports site covering your favorite teams across blogs and social media. PHLSportsNation.com. Philadelphia Sports Nation. PHL Sports Nation. Enhancing your Philadelphia sports fan experience. Philly cheesesteak or Philly soft pretzel?
Cheesesteak.
Center City or South Jersey?
Center City.
Gritty or Philly fanatic?
Gritty.
Meek Mill or Hall & Oates?
Meek Mill.
Dr. J, Sixers era throwback, or Allen Iverson, Sixers era throwback?
Allen Iverson.
Liberty Bell or Rocky Steps?
Liberty Bell.
All right. Now I want you to fill in the blank. Are you ready? Another ready. Six-pack. Here you go. Best restaurant in Philly is?
Vernick Fish.
Favorite Philly hangout spot is?
Rittenhouse Square.
Best heckle you ever heard from a Sixers fan, whether to you or an opponent?
The guy that gave Westbrook the finger right into his face.
I'm not going to reenact that, but I know what you're talking. It's like a meme. It's iconic. The most underrated Sixers player ever.
Ooh. TJ McConnell.
Favorite Sixers teammate ever?
TJ McConnell.
Funniest Sixers teammate you ever had?
TJ McConnell.
There's a theme here. All right, it's time for me now to give you a handful of artists from my music library, and you tell me if you have them in your library. Are you ready?
Sounds good.
Here we go. Biggie Smalls.
I got
Biggie.
It.
Biggie. Tears for Fears.
Nope.
Stevie Wonder.
Nope.
Wow. DJ Khaled.
Yep.
Fallout Boy.
Yep.
Here you go. Who do you listen to on a regular basis?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, you know, whoever's popular, Drake, Bieber, you know, I guess a little bit of hip hop, a little bit of pop, you know, whatever's on the radio these days typically is okay with me.
So you just named a couple of Canadian guys. You ever get together with them?
I wish. I've met Drake before, but Bieber has been number one on my list for so long, and I just have never had the chance to meet him.
Okay. About 10 years ago, you're getting ready for the NBA draft after 2 years at Michigan. You post a video from college. You're in your parents' backyard in Ontario, draining like 70 of 76 threes. And who puts it up there but Steph Curry? And it becomes viral. when he did that. And I don't know, there was even talk about you and Steph getting together for a three-point shooting contest. I don't know. Put that in perspective. Whatever became of that?
It was so crazy. It was just a weird time because we posted the video not expecting anything of it. And I remember I went to sleep that night. You know, the video had maybe 1,000 views or whatever, nothing crazy. And I woke up the next morning and my phone had like 1,000 notifications on it from Twitter, text messages, and every notification had Steph Curry's name in it. And I was like, what did Steph do last night? Cause it was playoff time. What did Steph do last night? And then I go on and I saw he responded to my video and then he was like, 3-point shootout sometime, ? And I was like, oh man, this is phenomenal. Especially because at that time I was starting to, you know, really try to emulate Steph and be like him. And he was kind of right on that, you know, horizon where he started to become one of the best players in the league. And so, we actually had things in place for him to come to my backyard and do a 3-point shootout. And TSN, the Toronto Sports Network, was going to broadcast it. And basically what happened was the NCAA stepped in and they said we weren't allowed to do it because it was like professional versus amateur and it was a televised event. And so they basically, there was like,
had you already declared for the draft?
No, this was after my freshman year. This is like,
oh, got it. Okay.
This is like 2 weeks after we lost to Louisville in the national championship.
Okay. Got it.
So, I wonder if now that would be allowed with like the NIL stuff.
Yeah. Right.
You know, who knows? I would just go ahead and say that Steph would not be able to beat me in my own backyard just because it's, you know, it's my backyard. Like I just know those rims. I know the wind, like I just have it all mapped out. But obviously, you know, if we were to do a 3-point shootout on a regular court, I might have to go with Steph on that one. Mm.
Dude's the greatest shooter of all time. He redefined the 3-point shot just in terms of how far out you could go. He's the king of the logo and all that. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to belabor that. You're finally coming after 2 years, all right? You're the 8th pick, a 29-win Sacramento team. I remember you said you had 3 coaches. Mike Malone, I guess, he started out as the coach. And, of course, the coach now of the world champion Denver Nuggets. What was the transition like for you? That must have been crazy going through 3 coaches as a rookie.
Yeah, it was pretty wild, especially coming from Michigan where, like, Coach Beilein had a very – you know, he ran a pretty tight ship, had things very organized and, you know, kind of set in stone. And it just felt like I couldn't find my footing that rookie year. Like it was just, things were constantly changing and, you know, I had like a different relationship with each coach. And then, you know, my role was different with each coach. And then by the end of the year, by All-Star break, George Karl came in and I remember my agent called me over All-Star break and he was like, hey, you know, so George Karl is going to be the coach. And he goes, I don't, you know, don't take it personally, but he was like, George Karl doesn't play rookies. He was like, you're not going to play again. And I was like, what do you mean he doesn't play rookies? He was like, I've had, you know, other players who have played for him and they just don't play as rookies. And then, you know, sure enough, I came back from All-Star break and it was like the first eight games I like didn't play. And then this is actually a good story that I would love to share. The first time I did play for George Karl, we were in LA playing the Clippers. And this was when it was Lob City. We're down 30 points midway through the third quarter. And so I'm like on the bench starting to like get loose a little bit because I'm like probably going to go in. And at the 2-minute mark, there's 2 minutes left in the third quarter. George looks down the bench. Nick, come in. So tearaways come off, run to the scores table. I'm checking in. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, who do you want me to check in for? And he goes, you know, get Ben McLemore. And he was like, you're going to guard Jamal Crawford. And so I like turned and I looked at where Jamal Crawford was. And Jamal was literally, again, Michigan guy. He was sitting there staring at me like I was about to be, you know, easy pickings. And keep in mind, Jamal had like 20, 25 already, full sweat. And I haven't stepped on the court yet this game. And so I'm like, oh man, this is going to be rough. I check into the game, first possession. They inbound to Jamal. And, you know, I look around me and all four other players are down on the baseline. And Jamal is just dribbling, you know, 35, 40 feet out. And I'm like trying to get in a stance here, but I'm like, you know, I'm a little bit stiff. I've just been sitting for an hour and a half. And so sure enough, you know, he hits me with a little crossover, pull up three, bam. And long story short, and, you know, next possession down, same thing, four down, pull up three, bam. And then holds for the last shot of the quarter on the third possession, four down again. And this time he just hit back-to-back threes. So I'm trying to press up on him a little bit and, you know, blew right by me, you know, goes to the rim and scores. And so he had 8 points in 2 minutes. And that was my first time playing for George Karl. And I was sitting, I go back to the bench and I'm just like, man, do I really belong here? Like, it was one of those welcome to the NBA moments for me where I'm like, ooh, this is not going to be as easy as I thought it was.
Well, it got a little more difficult in this respect. You came to Philadelphia and you played for a 10-win team. So let me flash back, July 2015. You're traded to a 76ers team that starts the year 0-18 and 1-30. It had four double-digit losing streaks. It never won consecutive games. What was it like being a part of the process?
Man, that was an interesting year to say the least. The only thing that I would say I took from it as a positive was I feel like the guys on that team, we were all very young. And so there was actually a great chemistry on that team from the point that we were all just starting our careers, early 20s, you know, some guys not even 20 years old yet, you know, all kind of trying to get a footing in the league. And so we were able to, you know, make some good friendships and connections in that way that are still, you know, lasting to this day, which I'm grateful for. But man, the day-to-day losing, that was unlike anything I've ever been a part of. And at times just like super frustrating, especially for a guy like me who is like trying to, you know, prove himself in the league and get going. It was hard for me mainly because like even when I would have a good game personally, you know, we would maybe lose by 15, 20, 25 points. And I would sit there and it's like after the game, it's like you can't even really celebrate or feel like you're improving in like personally because there's always these big losses hanging over your head. And so that was like the hard part for me where it was like difficult for me to feel like I was making any kind of progress because at the end of the day, I'm like, we're getting killed out here. And, you know, I would say later on in the year, like post, post New Year's, we started to string together again, not consecutive wins, but we were starting to compete a
be
little
more
bit
competitive.
More yeah. We were a little more competitive. But man, that first 2-3 months of the year, it was just abysmal. It was as bad as it gets.
By the way, in that trade that brought you from Sac to the Sixers, the first round pick traded by Sac to the Sixers in that deal turned out to be Jason Tatum. And the first round pick the Sixers traded to Sac turned out to be De'Aaron Fox. I just thought I would throw that in. Anyway, next year, Joel Embiid finally plays. You go up to 28 wins. Did you think, hey, you had maybe a future with this team?
It was definitely promising. And I remember that year specifically after All-Star break, we came back and I think we were like 9-2, 9-3 in our first couple of weeks after All-Star break. And then Joel, I think Joel hurt his knee in the Houston game, which was it was an ESPN game, I believe, at home. And it was like the first time, the first like couple week span where I was like, wait, we can actually beat teams. And teams had to like start taking us seriously because before that I could tell that teams would come in and play us and we would we could be up 6, 8, 10 points coming into the fourth quarter because they were just not really playing. And then come fourth quarter, teams would, vets would turn on that switch and we would crumble, you know, so quickly. And a 10 point lead would all of a sudden turn into being down by 8 points in like a 6 minute span. And the amount of times we did that throughout my first 2 years in Philly was, I mean, it was gut wrenching. But I guess those are the kinds of things you got to go through in order to learn and gain experience. But once Joel started playing, we definitely, one, saw how special he was. And then two, started saying, oh, okay, this team has some potential. Like there's some room here to kind of, you know, make our way into the playoffs and get our footing, which eventually the team did.
One night the Sixers are playing, you're in the game, it's in Toronto. You go up like 4 feet and you slam a ball in off of a putback. And I mentioned your name. And then I said, hold me back, fam. Do you remember that? It's the first time I used that. I had it in my hip pocket. Scott Rigo, then the equipment manager, gave it to me and I just kind of held it. Do you remember, seeing any texts in that regard or anything like that? Because I know that subsequent to that, you would see me in the hallway at games. You'd say, hold me back, fam. And it became like a thing that you and I eventually did.
It was so fitting that you said it in Toronto, which is my hometown. And fam is like a very, it's very, I wouldn't say it's Toronto slang because people say fam everywhere, but it very much is how people in Toronto would speak. Hold me back, fam. Like it was just so fitting that you said it there in Toronto. And strangely enough, I had 4 dunks that game. I'm like thinking back to it. I had 4 dunks that game. I was just extra bouncy. And that putback was one of those ones. I think it was Robert Covington shot a 3 from the left wing and I was in the right corner. And as he shot it, I started crashing from the weak side. And it was one of those things where it was like, I could tell the ball was going to bounce off the front of the rim and come to my side. And I just kind of got that perfect angle on it for a nice putback. And then, you know, it wasn't really the dunk. It was really your commentary that made the clip go viral on social media. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's when Hold Me Back Fam was born. And that became our little thing.
You mentioned being bouncy, being a white guy in a league that's dominated by black guys. Is it, do black guys come up to you? Has it become a topic of conversation? Do people say to you, hey, you get up good for a white guy? Does that ever enter into play?
Yeah. I mean, it was always like, oh, you're like sneaky bouncy or like, oh, you can kind of jump a little bit. I always got that a little bit. But yeah, I guess it gave me a little bit more street cred. When you're able to, throw down some dunks. I think that year I got a couple of good shot blockers on posters that year. I got Miles Turner on a poster and I got Bismack Biyombo on a poster that same game in Toronto when you yelled, hold me back, fam. So I was like building some street cred that year for sure.
There was one game where you did something in the game and somebody was watching with the subtitles on and I mentioned your name, Nick Stauskas, and for some reason the voice recognition system didn't recognize Nick Stauskas and it came up with Sauce Castillo. Mm-hmm. And that became a thing for a while. Did you ever try to capitalize on that with some kind of a product?
I did have my own hot sauce
I think I remember that now.
For a couple of years. It happened pretty quickly after the nickname was born. I didn't really ever think the nickname was going to stick, but it, you know, people loved it. They thought it was I think the story of how it came about with it being a closed captioning error. I think people really just latched on to that. But I mean, Sauce is a cool name. Like once people were asking me, like, are you okay with Sauce? I'm like, that's a pretty, I don't know if I'm going to get a better nickname than that. So I just, I stuck with it, got a little hot sauce deal. And then even now to this day, like when I'm in Philly walking down the street and someone says hi, like no one says, yo, Nick, what's up? Like everyone's, yo, Sauce, what's going on, man? How you? And so it still lives on to this day. Like I'm not in Philly. I'm Sauce only. So what it's what, you know, it's whatever the people want, but I'm all for it.
2017-18, Sixers acquired J.J. Redick, so playing time really dried up for you. Understandably, turned out to be a one of the greatest shooters in NBA history. You get traded to Brooklyn with Jahlil Okafor. You play for Brooklyn, Portland, Cleveland. Then you go to Spain, and you encounter a coach in Spain that has a five-hour practice. And the quote from you is, "This is why I'm never going to play in Europe again." Mm. A five-hour practice? What do you remember from that?
My goodness. These guys are just built different over there in Europe. Their ideology is very different. In terms of if you lose, it's always because you didn't work hard enough. And then it's like, you know, I'm going to show you tomorrow. Like when we get to practice, like we're going to punish you to like show you not to lose again. And so obviously in the NBA, it doesn't work like that. Like it's very much not like that. So, coming from the NBA to that was a little hard for me to come to grips with. And then, you know, add on to the fact that that was really the starting point for me where I was starting to deal with some, my left knee was really starting to bother me. And, you know, I don't know if this is one of the ones like the chicken or the egg, like, was it because I was doing two a days mid-season and having 5 hour practices? Like, I don't know, but it was the workload that we were doing over there was just unsustainable for what my current physical health was. And the issue that I had was that there was no wiggle room for like them to be like, hey, we have a game tomorrow, so like maybe you should take it easy the day before if like you're dealing with this injury. It was like, no. Let's ratchet it up, because the reason your knee's hurting is because you're not like in good enough shape. You need to like work harder and do more. And so it was just like, man, I love basketball. Like, I don't know if there's many people that love basketball the way I do. Like, I grew up playing 6, 7, 8 hours a day. I truly just love it. But that was the first time in my life where I sat there and was like, I don't know if I love this. Like that was just, it was like right at the brink for me where I was like, this isn't what I enjoy doing if this is what it's going to look like. And so, yeah, that's why, again, for me, like, you know, we talked about why I stepped away from basketball and, you know, with the NBA being out of, you know, or kind of a more difficult situation, I could have very easily said, man, let me continue playing in Europe and like make some more money for a couple more years. I very easily could have done it. But is that something that I want to go back to? Like that kind of ideology and just honestly, like just craziness. Like it wasn't something that I was passionate about. So, you know, I tip my hat to all the guys that go over there and do it. Because it's definitely not as glamorous as the NBA may be in some ways.
So now you're retired from something that you were very passionate about, as you just described. What's next for you? What's the future hold?
Well, interestingly enough, I would love to get into the broadcasting world. And I have a good amount of experience doing it. So, you know, I don't even know if you know, but during the process years in Philly, you know, obviously we weren't going to the playoffs. So come April, our season's over and now you don't resume playing until September or October. And so I was going back to Toronto as soon as our season was over, and I would work for TSN, the Toronto Sports Network, and I would cover all the Raptors playoff games. And so, you know, over my NBA career, I ended up probably doing 40, 50 Raptors playoff games. And I loved it. Like it was fun. I would watch the games at home anyway. So, you know, why not go to the game and, you know, talk about it. And so, the more I did it, the more comfortable I got. And, you know, I never really took it seriously at the time because basketball was my playing career was still the focus, but I knew then and there that after basketball was done, that was something that could be a good path for me down the road. So, you know, this whole last year, I kind of wanted to, you know, lay low and just be here with my newborn and, you know, figure out parent life and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, even looking forward to this next season, I have hopefully some things in the works where, I can do some broadcasting gigs. So we'll see.
You're from Toronto. You're living in the Philly area. Who's your NBA team? Be honest.
Who's my NBA team? That's interesting. I don't even, I mean, no team in particular. I'm more so just, I love watching Steph, love watching LeBron still. I'm more of like just, you know, I like to see a good matchup on TV, but I'm not necessarily rooting for anyone specifically anymore.
You watching the Sixers?
I do. I watched it. I was at a number of Sixers games this year. I was at the game. I went to the game where Joel won MVP this year. You know, I love watching Sixers games, and I love that I go there and it's all love with Sixers fans now, which is crazy because Philly fans, they hate you when you're playing for them, then they love you after you're done playing for them.
So, I wouldn't say that Sixer fans hated you. I'm of a different notion perhaps than you are. But since you watch the Sixers, maybe you have an opinion on this. What do they have to do to win a title with Joel Embiid?
It's a good question. Man, it's just I thought they had that Boston series. Like, it's just, I look back at that and like, man, I can't believe they weren't able to kind of, you know, pull through. I felt like if there was a year for them to do it, it was this last season. Like, that was their chance to do it. And, you know, now they've lost a couple pieces in free agency, and, you know, now they have all this, you know, drama with James and, you know, even Joel now a little bit. So I don't know, you know, I wouldn't sit here and say that they would be my favorites to win in the East this year, but obviously when you have a player of Joel's talent, like, you're always going to have a chance. And by the way, he's unbelievable, Joel. Like, I mentioned I was at the game where he won MVP, and I saw him afterwards, and I just, like, I gave him the biggest hug, and I was like, dude, I'm so happy for you and proud of you. Like, he has just come such a long way with his maturity, his, you know, his body, his mind, like, everything kind of has, like, come together where it's like an unstoppable force. And so, yeah, I'm so happy for him that he's been able to kind of overcome the injuries and all the stuff early on in his career to get to that point where, like, man, you're the best player in the world. Like, you are MVP of the best basketball league in the world. Like, it's truly a phenomenal story. So, I hope for him, and I hope for the city of Philadelphia that it can work out. I would just say that coming into this season with, like, the storylines that are going on, I don't know if this is going to be the year for them, but again, when you have a guy like Joel, you know, reigning MVP, you're always going to give yourself at least a chance.
Nick Stauskas, it was a real pleasure, my friend, even though you probably could have played a little bit longer. I agree with your priorities, being at home, being a husband, being a father. I wish you all the best being a broadcaster. I'm so happy you settled in the Philly area. We do love you here in spite of what it is that you may have thought while you were playing. Thank you so much for giving us your time. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you. And yeah, it's all love. Hold me back, fam.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of Fresh 24. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts.